Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Ehrink, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, Kathy Barks Hoffman, the journalist, or the newest inductee to the Journalism Hall of Fame, but with Martin Wehmeyer. Thanks for making the trek over here today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Kyle.
I'm glad that the weather warmed up a little bit, so you're not a popsicle now that you're here.
Yeah, it was a nice stroll over.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, we've got a lot of things to talk about today. Aaron Knott from Equality Michigan is going to be joining us here in a little bit. But, John, now that we've had a few days to digest Governor Whitmer's first budget as a sitting governor, let's try and compare what this budget is like compared to the budgets of prior governors. Was this a budget that looked more like a Blanchard budget, Engler budget, Granholm budget, Snyder budget? Where would you put this?
I think it's a budget that shows that Gretchen Whitmer's, it was far more of a political creature than Rick Snyder was as governor. I think you can kind of see sort of the interconnectedness of the ideas there. I think she was clearly has got some ideas about what she can bargain away in terms of what she needs to get for the roads. I think she's already started to signal some of that stuff. It reminded me a lot more of a John Engler budget than a Rick Snyder budget or a Jennifer Granholm budget.
Would you agree with that, Kathy?
Yeah, I would. And I do remember when John Engler became governor, you know, he said that he had been told, you know, be bold. And so he did walk in. Actually, the last time, other than the small gasoline tax increase we got under the Snyder administration, that was the last time we really had a significant gas tax increase was under Governor Engler. And that took a lot of arm twisting, as I remember. But I think that this was a budget that clearly said we are underinvesting in our state. That is not making us a place that people want to move to and businesses want to invest in. And we have to fix these problems if we want to become that state.
It seemed to be a budget, Jacob, that was a lot about splash. You know, you put the big number out there. You put that $2.5 billion number out there. You put the 45-cent number out there. And it was more of an attention grabber than it was a serious proposal, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, the budget presentation was very interesting. You had the governor lead it off. And when if you go through her presentation and how she did it, she made more of the emotional appeal or the kind of the passionate appeal of like, here are the problems and here's how we fix it. And then her budget director came later and kind of filled in the holes. But her role was to kind of champion, here are the issues that we need to solve. And actually saying, like having the audacity to say, like, my budget, if you adopt it, will solve it. And as we mentioned in our article, like, she tried to sell it to lawmakers as you need to take one historic vote to kind of address all of these issues. So I thought it was pretty interesting how she came across and tried to present it that way.
So, John, she's not going to get a 45-cent tax increase, but what is she going to get?
She's going to get close to $1.5 billion by the time she's done with it. Look, think about what she did. So she came out and called for a 45-cent gas tax that I don't think anybody around this table thinks she's actually going to get. But right away, what happened? The Michigan Chamber of Commerce came out and gave almost tacit approval to such a funding increase. The business leaders of Michigan has kind of come out and said, that's what we need. She's kind of almost outflanked the Republicans because given them support because the business community has said, yeah, we have underinvested, and yeah, we've got to fix it. So where that comes from, though, I don't think it's going to be that big of a gasoline tax increase. I think she can get there, though, from a variety of different places.
I was surprised, Kathy, that the Republicans are also kind of hands-off as of right now. Maybe this changes about the trucks, and should the trucks be paying more? You had that report from the Mackinac Center, of all things, saying that the trucks are causing more damage to the roads than what they're paying compared to passenger vehicles, and yet the Republicans don't seem to be interested in that route.
This is a perennial issue, though. I mean, how often have we heard that the trucks are ruining the roads and they need to pay more money? And quite frankly, there was a time when the diesel tax was lower than the gasoline tax, and it got raised partly on that argument that trucks are using diesel fuel and they're not paying their fair share. I don't know that they're going to be able to, though, go out and charge more to trucks at this point.
But then where do they go? I mean, and you've heard all the arguments, you've heard of all the different pots of money. If not that, then what?
Well, I think that she wants to raise the gas tax. I mean, that is the primary part of it.
What do Republicans do, though?
Well, That's what I'm wondering. Yeah. I mean, that they say they have their own plan. We haven't seen it yet. And, you know, if it's going to be taking the sales tax that's paid on gasoline and putting that towards gasoline, I don't think that's going to fly with the Whitmer administration. It takes way too much money away from K through 12, as far as she's concerned. And I think, if anything, the governor is saying that we're underfunding our K through 12 public education as we are now. So she's not going to agree to that. I think she has a strong argument, and maybe while you're seeing the business community supporting this, in saying, you know what, this is a use tax, people understand it, you know, we can say we're putting the money towards roads, that is a lot more palatable to most people, no matter what the final number ends up being, than any other kind of, we're going to fix it with this and with that. I mean, that's what we saw with the ballot proposal that failed a couple years ago, is it was too complex. You know, there was going to be money for this and money for that, and people didn't trust it, so they turned it down overwhelmingly. Republicans say that shows they don't want a gas tax increase. I think it was that it was too complex. And so I think if she sticks to a simple message, this money will go to fix the roads, I think she's ahead.
But it seems like, Jacob, in order for the Republicans to do this without the gas tax increase, they almost have to create their own chain of dominoes, which is what, as you mentioned, the Whitmer budget was. It was a chain of dominoes. You knock over this gas tax, then you move the school aid fund money back into schools, take it out. It was its own chain, and it seems like the Republicans would have to do that as well. If you take the gasoline, or you take the sales tax on gasoline, take that out, and then raise the gas tax by the appropriate amount, then you got to do something with schools. And then when you do something with schools, then you're probably going to affect higher ed. And eventually, you're going to have to increase some tax somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's the issue, and I think that's what the governor tried to address in her budget. I mean, the way the funds are set up, it kind of affects everything else. The Republicans wanted to use general fund to help fund the roads back in 2015, and the governor has pointed out that general fund hasn't changed in 20 years or so, and that's supposed to be for other things like our, you know, health programs and things like that. So I think that's where part of her argument for the gas tax comes from, is that we need to raise revenue somewhere, and it needs to be for roads. And then that kind of starts the chain where you can return the general fund back to universities and put it back into K-12. And so from her, it all looks good. But yeah, Republicans would need to pull lever here or there to kind of figure something out like that.
Does any of you three believe that this Mike Shirky idea, that he's kind of passively tossed out there about linking miles driven to how much money you pay to help fix the roads, is that an idea that gets anywhere, this thing that they're doing in Oregon?
That's a new technology, and people have to accept the technology and, you know, agree to the fact that there's something on their car that's tracking that. I mean, I think a lot of the argument is that this is a tax. The gasoline tax is a tax on miles driven. You drive a lot, you pay more. You drive less, you pay less. And, you know, she's offsetting that somewhat by trying to raise the earned income tax credit so that if you're low income, and because a large proportion of your money goes directly, if you drive at all, you're going to be hit, that you get some recourse back. Some relief from that. So I just think that she's going to argue that this is a tax on miles driven. And I think the technology, people really aren't quite there yet.
Think about the conservative Republicans and all the brouhaha we've heard over smart meters and all this, you know, Big Brother is watching. And you want to take that and put it in your car and give a state of database about how many miles you're driving and when? It's not going to fly.
Yeah, the privacy concerns are the big thing. That's what it sounded like what turned away that study from Sycama and Emerson. That turned them off from even kind of going into that further, from what I saw. If you get past that, the question is, this miles driven thing, is that a better user fee than the gas tax? And I don't know if that question has been answered.
She is increasing, you know, they are increasing registration fees for hybrids and for electric cars, because, of course, there is that issue of they're not paying gasoline taxes.
Right.
So there's a little bit of that in there as well.
So here's the next question, guys. Is the honeymoon over? The honeymoon with Gretchen Whitmer and the Senate leadership. I got a suggestion over the week that the honeymoon is over. I want to get you guys' impression. Yes or no?
I think that the fact that the Republican legislators are still polite when they disagree with her, so shows that the honeymoon isn't over yet. I mean, we all know how cutting things can be over at the Capitol when people really are digging in. I don't think people are dug in yet, so I don't think the honeymoon's quite over.
I would say No, and the way you would determine when the honeymoon is over is when the legislature and the governor run out of things that they can work on, that they can agree on, like civil asset forfeiture. I think the messaging you hear from what you hear publicly from both sides is not a good indicator of how people really feel about each other. So when we actually have to hit the rubber hits the road and we have to start negotiating over some of these things that the governor has now linked to our state budget, that's when we'll know how the honeymoon's doing.
Yeah, I would agree with you guys, John. I don't know if you agree with this, but I agree. I don't think the honeymoon's over yet because I don't think things have really gotten nasty. And we've seen very contentious relationships at the Capitol, the Bishop-Granholm relationship, the relationship with Tom Leonard and Arlen Meekhoff. I mean, those were really contentious relationships. Or I still remember when Ken Sikkema blew his top over at the Capitol to get his point across on something. And we haven't seen anyone lose their cool yet. It's still about the issues.
Yeah, and I think it's the honeymoon's going to last longer with this particular governor because I think she has a tougher hide than Jennifer Granholm did. I think she's been part and parcel of the political process long enough that she realizes there's rhetoric for party purposes and then there's personal animus. And I think she can endure a lot more political rhetoric hits than probably Jennifer Granholm or maybe even Rick Snyder could.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, Jacob, these newest numbers from Epic MRA about the approval rating of Gretchen Whitmer and Donald Trump. And I thought this was interesting. I wanted you to read those numbers for us.
Donald Trump is at total favorability of 40%. And we have the governor at 43%. The president's total unfavorable is 55%. And we have the governor's at 25%.
Just to let that sink in for a minute then, Gretchen Whitmer's favorability rating is only 3 percentage points higher than Donald Trump's. Is anyone else surprised by that?
Well, I think the fact that if you add up 43 and 28, 25, you've got a large number of undecided people. She has not been in office very long, and I think people simply don't have an opinion at this point.
Is that so? If you're Gretchen Whitmer at this point, John, you're not freaking out.
I wouldn't freak out. If she can get through a major package to actually fix the roads in 3 years, people are just going to be ecstatic.
But right now, they're not excited about the prospects of paying 71 cents of gas tax, Jacob.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would be worried about if the governor is someone who worries about unfavorability is if you have this level that you're at right now and you have a lot of people who are undecided, which is true, I think it's at 28%. What I think has finally reached the ears of the general electorate is this gas tax. I spoke with a friend who is a constituent services person for a representative, and I asked him, you know, what are you dealing with this week? Because I know he has to deal with constituent calls, and it's been, you know, off the charts, this gas tax thing. I mean, I'm talking about making sure there's a form email going out to, you know, dozens of people. So this is something that has caught the attention of the general electorate, and it will be interesting to see what that does to these numbers.
In a bad way, or?
Oh, yeah, they're totally concerned, totally outraged by it.
Yeah. That shouldn't be surprising, though, should it, Kathy?
Well, I don't think it should be surprising, and I think it once again shows that Gretchen Whitmer has a level of legislative experience that her predecessors, after John Engler, have not had, and that she knows that you're going to have to negotiate back down towards the middle. And I think she has, you know, she's gone for the absolute number that would solve the problem, but is she expecting to get there? Probably not. And just like legislators, I think the voting public, you know, if you come in less than that, they're going to feel like, oh, we dodged a bullet. We didn't get 45-cent increase. And she's very aware of how the optics work, I would think, and how people psychologically are going to react to this. She knows she's not going to be at that top point. But, you know, she also knows that people will feel relieved if she comes in lower than that eventually.
I don't know where I heard this, but I think that this is true, is that when Rick Snyder and Jennifer Granholm proposed a budget or did a proposal, they were trying to propose something that the legislature would like and that would just approve, which we all know is not how it works, whereas Governor Whitmer's doing more what John Engler did, was shoot for the moon and then start negotiating
point. Because like we've already said, she's already established and buttressed the fact that we've got this huge hole, we've got to fill it. She's laid it out there as 45-cent gasoline tax, which is going to come off the general public at large. Now she can go back and say, well, you've already acknowledged we've got this hole. I mean, Shirky already said, basically, yeah, we do have to raise $2.5 billion. He kind of backed off it later, but he did actually admit it. So Now you can actually negotiate. All right, well, we're going to take one-third of that in gasoline tax maybe. We're going to take one-third of it maybe in different fee changes for trucking or business or a business tax. We're going to take one-third maybe from cuts or moving money around within state government. And then you can actually start to put together the puzzle. But she's at least got her opponents saying, you're right, Governor, we do have a $2.5 billion problem. And so she's a lot further down the road.
She's agreed to the size of the puzzle.
Yeah, and that's a big win, you know, getting everybody, especially in the contentious, you know, political environment we have today, to agree to a fact.
That's a big win.
And, you know, I know she's going to probably make the argument, or her administration will, that you're already paying, you know, what is it, $300 or $400 a year in, you know, getting realignments done and things like this. That's more than what you're going to be paying for the gas tax increase and for the average driver. You know, there's a lot of other arguments she can be making on this going forward.
Well, thank you, Kathy, for sitting in on this. We're going to bring in Aaron Knott now and from Equality Michigan, and we'll continue the conversation. All right, joining us now in MERS World Headquarters is Aaron Knott. She's the Interim Director at Equality Michigan. Aaron, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me here today.
So for people who don't know you, tell us a little bit about your background, where you came from, and how you got to this position.
Sure. So I've been working in political strategy for the last 10, 15 years or so. I formerly was the political director at America Votes, and then had the distinguished honor of being the state director for the Michigan program for Enroll America. That was the organization that made President Obama's signature policy initiative successful by mobilizing people to the marketplace, connecting them to coverage, and then making sure that they understood how to use their insurance once they had it.
So that was kind of a public relations arm after the Affordable Care Act was put into place. And how long were you at Enroll Michigan?
Enroll America? I was there for just over 4 years.
And then how long have you been with Equality Michigan?
I've been with Equality Michigan, Michigan exactly 2 years today. I came to the organization after Enroll America sunsetted in 2017. I've had a variety of different titles, most of them working in the political arena for the organization.
And so with Equality Michigan now, I understand you guys were a little bit more involved in the 2018 elections than you have before. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. We had an opportunity to partner with the Promote the Vote ballot initiative to help get the word out about you know, basically making it easier for all of us to exercise our fundamental right of voting. And we piloted a project in Southwest and Western Michigan where at the end of the day, we knocked on 22,000 doors and talked to them not only about Promote the Vote, Prop 3, but also about what was at stake for pro-equality voters up and down the ballot.
Because up until then, you guys have endorsed in like legislative races and candidates that have been friendly to people from the LGBTQ community, but you haven't been involved in like the high level races, if that's my understanding.
We have a pride pack that has made endorsements in previous elections, and we did in 2018. But you're right, we've never engaged in field work around elections where we're in communities with volunteers knocking on doors and talking to people about the issues that matter.
And you guys have a 501c3 and a 501c4. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's correct. We have a 501c3, a C4, as well as a pack known as the Pride Pack.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the issues that are going on right now. Clearly, the governor has put out her State of the State address, and she would like to see the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act expanded. It doesn't look like the legislature is going in that direction. What's kind of the next step on this? Is it to go through the Civil Rights Commission, or is there going to be another effort to try and get the legislature to move on this?
Well, we recognize that it's going to be an uphill battle. I mean, the landscape, the statements made, you know, in the news recently by the majority leader or the Speaker of the House, you know, there appears that leadership doesn't have an appetite to give an amendment to Elliott Larson an up or down floor vote. That being said, the majority of Michiganders are on the side that it's well past time for sexual orientation and gender identity to be included in our state's Civil Rights Act. So we are working in coalition across the state of Michigan. We are building bipartisan support. We are building a corporate employer based community that recognizes that an amendment to Elliott Larson helps attract and retain talent. We are working with faith leaders and just Michiganders, again, all across the state of Michigan to build support, to talk to elected officials, and hopefully move the ball forward.
Aaron, based on what you just said there, would the strategy to expand Elliott Larson, would that include potentially looking at another ballot drive or some kind of legal avenue to kind of maybe look at the law?
I don't think that anybody wants to raise the $15 to $20 million that would be necessary for a ballot initiative. That being said, Equality Michigan is prepared that if we fail at the legislative level, if it becomes strikingly obvious that we are not going to have a floor vote and that we've exhausted all options, then we are positioned to have a conversation as it relates to taking it to the ballot.
Have you seen movement among Republicans on this issue? In the past, I mean, just going back 10 years, it didn't seem like there was any Republican who was friendly to this idea. Have you seen changes in that?
Yes, we have. In talking with my friends in the legislature, they've talked to me about colleagues that they have that are supportive of this work. I've had my own conversations with some Republican lawmakers that have privately said, I support this. It's well past time. We just have to get leadership to move.
So it's really a leadership thing at this point.
Yes. And, you know, there was those statements made by Speaker Chatfield as it related to discrimination just doesn't exist. If it did, we'd see it in the media. I've reached out to his office a couple of times now requesting a meeting with him to talk to him about the victims that we serve at Equality Michigan. Last year, we served well over 400 people that have experienced some form of discrimination, harassment, and at times violence. This year, we have a goal of serving over 550 people across the state of Michigan. We have pop-up office hours in communities, east to west and then up in Traverse City. And I think that leadership needs to hear these stories and to see these victims.
One thing that you've heard in the past, and I'm not sure if this is still the case with Republicans who may not be receptive to this, is they've often kind of added on as we need to have religious beliefs exemption, carve out, what have you. Is that still an area of compromise for Equality Michigan, or is that kind of a non-starter when Republicans start talking that way?
You know, whatever you want to call it, religious exemptions, religious liberties, some people call it religious freedoms. You know, our religious liberties are protected in the Constitution and across, state laws across the United States, right? I think of religious exemptions as a way in which to discriminate against another body. So as we're talking about a reintroduction of Elliott Larson, right now we want a clean bill that doesn't include a religious exemption, that includes both sexual orientation and gender identity, and that's where we're going to start this year.
If you had a vote in the House and the bill was up to expand Elliott Larson as you'd like to, how many yes votes do you think you would get out of 110 members?
Well, that would that would mean that we would actually have a floor vote.
No, but if we did, let's just say hypothetically, do you think you could get 55 votes?
Yes.
You think you could get 60?
Yes.
Wow. So it would pass.
I'm confident that it would pass. Again, the appetite across the state right now is that we are past time to do this work. Okay. You know, the Human Rights Campaign, in collaboration with the Equality Federation, released a state equality index not too long ago. And Michigan is racing towards the bottom right now, right? We are on the leaderboard of being one of the most inequitable states in the United States. And that's unacceptable, particularly if you're thinking about things like employment, again, attracting and retaining talent, about treating people, with fairness and dignity, regardless of their circumstances. Again, we're racing towards the bottom right now.
And then in the Senate, could you get 20 votes in the Senate?
The Senate's another game right now. I'm not confident that we could get 20 votes in the Senate.
The Attorney General and the Civil Rights Director have announced sort of an effort to track the same groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified as hate groups and to document incidences of hate that may not rise to something that's prosecutable. Some on the right have suggested that's not a role for government. Why is that important? Or what's your reaction? Is that an important role for government to sort of track that and to publicize that? And if so, why?
As the question was asked, I was thinking about my coworker, Janice, who is our trans victim advocate based predominantly in the Metro Detroit area. And she speaks about the violence and discrimination, the harassment that happens to trans women of color on a daily basis. We've all seen the headlines of the trans woman who was shot in the middle of broad daylight not too long ago. I think that, again, going back to Speaker Chatfield and even the majority leader saying that discrimination doesn't exist. If it did, we'd see it in the headlines. I know that that's not the case because I'm interfacing with victims all the time, either one-on-one or stories are lifted up from my staff. I think that we should be tracking this. I think that there are folks in leadership positions that, you know, are kind of stuck in a bubble and they don't recognize what's going on in communities outside of that bubble. And if this helps bring forward, again, the pain and suffering that's happening to people just because of who they are, I'm all for it.
So do you have any data or has there been a report or anything that looks into when a state has gone and done something like Elliot Larson, that incidences of harassment or discrimination have gone down? Is there a connection? I mean, if we passed it tomorrow, would you see your caseload go down?
I think that in states that have passed Elliot Larson, there are benchmarks that are visible, that are obvious. What I'm trying to get at is the fact that it will be prosecutable.
Mm.
You know?
That's the difference.
There's always going to be, unfortunately, discrimination and harassment, but now there will be recourse. There will be an avenue for folks to say, hey, listen, I was fired because I'm a lesbian, and now I want recourse for that termination, right? And we have that now because of the interpretive statement that came out of the Michigan Civil Rights Commission in May of 2018, and they have taken half a dozen or more complaints, and they're working those complaints through the process. But state law is state law, right? We need a legislative solution. And I am confident that when we pass an amendment to Elliot Larson, we will start to see people that feel right now that they have no recourse, there's nowhere for them to go, they will be able to file, you know, a proper complaint and then seek some sort of compensation for their harm and suffering.
But how do these things work out in reality? I'm a small business owner. I'm making on the margin. I'm not making a whole lot of money, but I've got enough of a budget. I'm going to hire somebody. I've got five candidates. One of them is gay, let's say, and this law's on the books, and I'm saying there that person's as good, maybe a little better than the other ones. But if things don't work out between me and that person, I may be facing a lawsuit. Does that go to, before the hiring even takes place, does this possibly eliminate some jobs for some of these people?
I think that right now, companies have the right to let an employee go if they're not working out, if they're not meeting benchmarks, if they're not a good fit, if a corrective action plan is put in place and that employee doesn't meet the metrics, the benchmarks, then by all means, employers have the right to let that employee go.
But if I'm an employer, you tell me all small business employers do all those things right now? Suddenly I'm sitting there saying, if I hire that person, I'm going to have to do all that paperwork ahead of time in case it doesn't work out.
I guess I reject the question because a small business owner would be potentially, if they come to the table with racial bias or religious bias, they would be saying the same thing. Again, people are people. And if the person is hired to meet a certain set of job responsibilities and they're not living up to those expectations, an employer has the right to terminate them based on performance.
I've actually talked to some business representatives who are gun-shy about this. And the reason they're gun-shy about it has more to do with facilities. They're worried that if there's a dispute between, say, a transgender employee and another gender about the bathroom usage, and that they don't want to get into that. Is that really an issue?
So there's research. You can go to the Movement Advancement Project. They have research that looks at states that have fully inclusive non-discrimination laws on the books, right? And there aren't incidences related to the bathrooms.
There are not. And I should have asked this out front, and maybe you did answer and I forgot, but how many states are like Michigan in that they do not have civil rights protections in the law for gays, lesbians, and then maybe transgender individuals is a different category?
So I think the number is Michigan's part of the elite team of 32 right now. 32 states don't have non-discrimination laws across the board.
Is that different for gay and lesbians and then transgender?
I can't break it out.
Okay.
For you. Back to the employer conversation just real quick. There's a major company, a big player that has talk to me as well as a local municipal government about how difficult it is for them to bring in employees at the upper level, because they're, you know, it's two gay men and the spouse isn't covered not only by our state laws, but by a non-discrimination ordinance locally. And this company has been instrumental in initiating a non-discrimination ordinance conversation at the local level. Hmm. And we're at 40-some municipalities across the state of Michigan that have these, but it's a patchwork system and it doesn't work. And I'll give you an example. In Kalamazoo County, there's the city of Kalamazoo, the township of Kalamazoo, as well as Portage. And my partner and I, we're pretty safe as long as we stay in those three municipalities. But we can go a mile, mile and a half in any direction and technically be refused service just because we're lesbians.
You service at like a restaurant or something like that?
That's right.
Erin Knott, she is the interim director of Equality Michigan. Thanks for coming over to MERS World Headquarters today.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
That's going to do it for the MERS Monday podcast. Special thanks to Erin Knott for coming over here, Kathy Hoffman as well, Jack, John, Mike, and also Jacob Kanzler. And also special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.